In this episode, we wait out there with Alice Owsley from West Yellowstone, Montana. Growing up in Ohio, Alice learned to fly fish the same year she learned how to ski. She moved out west at the age of 22 after falling in love with the mountains of Wyoming and became a ski instructor and a fly fishing guide who was always focused on saying yes to opportunities to teach and grow. Now, Alice is a fly fishing guide and an outfitter in Yellowstone National Park and on the Madison River. We discuss techniques Alice has picked up for teaching newcomers to fly fishing, deciding where and how to fish in Yellowstone, and sight fishing tactics for trout above and below the surface. Welcome to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Shemchuk. At Wade Out There, we believe fly fishing is special, but not elite, and that anyone can become a great fly fisher if they are willing to go, learn, and teach. Join me as I talk with other fly fishermen and women about their unique journeys into fly fishing, the rivers they fish, and the tactics and philosophies they practice. For those who can never leave the river in their hearts, this podcast is dedicated to helping you make the memories that keep us all coming back to Wade Out There. Welcome, Alice. Thanks for being on the Wade Out There podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I love talking to folks that are out there fly fishing in Montana. My audience knows that's a pretty special fishery for me from growing up as a kid out there and, you know, vacations as a child going to the park, Yellowstone and all that. And I just think it's a great fishery, a special fishery, and I'm excited to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jason.
The other thing, I mean, I don't want to talk about this. I want to keep it fishy, but I just have to say that I saw that you are a PSIA level 2 ski instructor, and I think that's cool for a couple of reasons. One, we just moved out to Utah, so I'm skiing a lot these days. I've got a buddy who is, he's trying to get his certification. And so he's always like kind of giving me tips and stuff and practicing. And it's no joke. Like he's like fully like working hard, like studying to like get this thing done. So I think that that's cool. I mean, congratulations on that. And also I thought it was cool that, you know, even when the rivers are getting cold and it's icing up, like instruction and teaching, I think is something that's important to you. Is that one of the things that drew you to that aspect of the winter sports too?
Yes, definitely. I moved out west after college, and I really enjoyed the aspect of having real winter after being in the Southeast and being in the East Coast and a little bit in the Midwest. So I was happy to have real winter, and I was skiing in the winters and working at a ski resort. And so the natural progression for me, I started out working in the ski school, was then to become a ski instructor. And at the time, I just went for every certification and teaching opportunity I could. Shout out to Grand Targhee Ski Resort in the Tetons. It is my favorite place to go skiing, and that's where I was working at the time. And it's a small ski resort. And at the time, which this was the late 90s, early 2000s, I learned to be a yes ski instructor. And so I taught a tele lesson. I taught snowboarding once. Like I primarily was an Alpine kids ski instructor because I was young and there was like four women who worked in the whole ski school. So Naturally a lot of us ended up teaching kids, but I tried to teach as many adults, but it really just became, you say yes so that you work a bunch because that's what happens at a small ski resort. You need to be available and you say yes. And that's how the system worked at the time. I think things are a little different now. So I was motivated to get my level 2 because I was skiing a ton and I had great support and trainers at the ski resort.
That's cool.
And it pushed me with my own personal skiing. And I have to say now I'm not currently teaching skiing or alpine or Nordic, but I maintain my certification as best I can. And I do ski a bunch. I have a season pass up at Big Sky. So I ski during the week on my days off in the winter when I can. So
I learned to ski at Red Lodge.
And oh, nice.
Ridger Bowl. Yeah, that's the closest resort. So when I was a kid, we would tag it on like a couple days. My dad like would take us skiing after, like we were going hunting, like deer hunting out by on the ranch, and then ski a little bit. And then Bridger Bowl. I've never been to Big Sky, but I think a yes ski instructor. So were you guiding fly fishing too then? And did that transfer over? Because when I hear like you say, I said yes to a lot of things, like teaching wise, that's a positive mental attitude in my mind. That's someone who's like, yeah, let's do it. It's only going to help. I'm only going to learn. I'm only going to get better. How did that attitude work in fly fishing? Was there a difference there, or did you notice that transfer from one to the other? Which were you doing first?
I was fly fishing first. I would say as a kid, I probably learned how to fly fish and ski in the same year, ironically. And I don't know what it was. Maybe my brother was 5, and that could be part of it, that once my younger brother was a little bit more involved in sports, that my parents were like, gung ho, let's go do things. But yeah, ironically, that same year I learned to ski and fish. I would say that teaching has always been fundamental to my kind of entry and involvement in the fly fishing industry. And the very first thing that I ever did in the industry was I helped teach a women's fly fishing course with the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program in Corvallis, Oregon, with Donna Teeny. And this is a whole tangent, but I was working.
Okay. That's fine. We could go on tangents. It's fine. We're going to talk tactics. We're going to keep it tactical. I know that I want to talk tactics, but I'm excited. I want to hear about this.
So I worked in Oregon at Oregon State University one summer while I was in college, because I was studying forestry and I was focused on entomology and I wanted to be a forest entomologist. So early days of the internet and emails, I found a job at Oregon State University working in the forest entomology lab. And I thought, this is perfect. I can, maybe if this works out and I really like it, this is where I'll go to graduate school. This will be my program. While I was there, I visited the local fly shop, the Scarlet Ibis, and which I don't think exists anymore. And I found out there was a local club. So I started tying flies during the week, and then the club had outings during the weekends, and I was working a Monday through Friday kind of 9-to-5 schedule. And so I would meet up with the club and go on their outings. Like, I joined just for the summer, so I'd tie flies, go on outings, and would hang out in the shop every once in a while and meet different people. And they said, hey, they're doing this program and you seem to have an interest in teaching and instructing or getting involved, so why don't you go help teach that weekend? And so that was kind of my first intro, was teaching. And I think that's an important part of being in the industry, is sharing some of that knowledge from experience. And then also, I have since tried to become a better instructor, kind of similar to the ski instructor part, where being a certified ski instructor is not just being a good skier, but it's being a good teacher of skiing,
right,
and guide and instructor. That takes training, and that's been the same for fly fishing, where I've gotten involved in different programs, a few types of certifications and training. Like, I have also tried to become a better instructor, and I actually have a casting coach who helps me with my own personal casting, but then we run through presentations of casting, and we talk about having a lesson plan and a program, and education is not necessarily his background, but he wants me to be a good caster and he wants me to be a good casting instructor. And so I will fully admit, I have signed up for casting classes and lessons with other people strictly to study how they teach. Not that I didn't need to work on the skills, but studying how they taught. And I think that's an important thing as an instructor and as a guide, to have a program, have your ducks in a row so that you can be a professional when you're teaching.
Bunch of stuff on that.
I know. Sorry.
I mean, no, that's great. A bunch of stuff. I think that's awesome. I think from my experience instructing in airplanes and in the fighter squadron, it's very obvious that the best fighter pilots are not the best instructors. Sometimes they are, but it's not a given, right? It's not like just because this person can go out and crush it on the river that they're not, they might be the last person that you would give to that one guest. If you're an outfitter, right? You'd be like, I don't know about Jason. We're not going to put him with these guys. And so I think it's cool that you recognize that, and that you formalize it in your kind of structure, your life structure, your fly fishing world, that it's this thing that you think about. I'm curious, what are some of the things that you have picked up from, the study of instructing, like the idea of what do you look for? And then how do you go into that? How do you transfer that over? And do you have like a game plan or like a flow that you kind of like, okay, I'm going to assess and then I'm going to do this. Is it more fluid? Or, I mean, you sound very like structured. It sounds like you got a plan. So I'm wondering if there's a plan once you get on the river, or if that's more free flowing.
I think a lot of it has to do with the skills and the expectations of my clients. I will say I also minored in outdoor leadership in college, so that was
perfect.
Yeah, there's some legitimate things here that come right out of my studies, but and also from my own reading and pursuits. But you know, there's an aspect of customer service in there, and just how you're meeting and greeting the clients, and sure, I think that's something that is part of the program. And communication, maybe, like I said, with expectations kind of before you meet them, like knowing that you have two people in your boat, one of them is an avid angler and their partner who's in the boat with them is like, yeah, I go fishing with them, I kind of like it, but that less avid angler doesn't really want me on their shoulder constantly telling them, do this,
mend.
You know, they may be observing everything that's going on and kind of taking it all in and getting familiar with it. And they're going to continue to participate in this sport, but they don't want me to get really on them about certain things. And if it's working, usually with those folks, if what they're doing is working, sometimes they just want to set it and forget it and just keep going. And so I have to read that. But then on the other hand, and this is me thinking about a particular client, the avid angler that's in the bow of the boat says to me, Alice, I know we're going to nymph all day today because of the time of year, the water levels, when I came to fish with you. If we have any opportunity where I could learn how to dry fly fish, then I want to learn how to throw streamers. And they're like throwing all this stuff at me. And I'm like, okay, so it's an 8-hour day. Let's see if we can get all that in today. So then I have to say, okay, this person wants to catch fish and they want to learn all these new things. So I'm going to figure out the right time of day where I have to say, gosh, I know the fishing is really good right now with what we're doing, but you said you wanted to learn these two things. This is the time of the day when we need to totally re-rig, and I've got to set you up on a different program. And so, then I have to, you know, I have to kind of read that with them. Are they going to say at the end of the day, oh, wish I caught more fish today? And then I go, well, you said you wanted to learn these different things, and we know that they may not have been the best technique at the time and the place to catch fish, but you wanted to take your time with your fishing guide to learn, and that's part of the program.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I guess also where, I mean, maybe people are listening to this being like, well, I'm not a guide and I don't really want to be a guide, and so this is irrelevant to me, but I would tell those people that I don't know that it's super irrelevant, because I mean, for me, what I'm thinking about is when I teach my kids or I teach my wife, or if I teach like a friend, I've got, now that I've moved to Utah, I've got a lot of friends that are like, oh, I mean, I'm fly fishing a lot and they want to go and learn. And so I'm trying to teach them. I'm falling back on skill sets I had as an instructor. If you have, like, if you take that out of it, and this is probably the last thing I'll ask you about instructing and stuff, but if you take that out of it, if you take the guest, the client guide relationship out of it, and you're just teaching, like your best friend comes to you and she's never wanted to fly fish, and now he or she is like, Alice, I want to learn, like, what are some things that you do with that person? For example, one of the things that I do is I'll at some point I just stop, like just let them go and let them, you know, I need to stop saying words and just give them an opportunity to just be, do the thing, you know, especially with my son. Like I'll tell him something. And if I keep talking to him, like, but let him go, then that'll work a little bit better. That's an example. What are some other things that you might do with that person that came to you, technique wise, specifically fly fishing, where you're like, these things I've seen gains, I've seen positive rewards or positive results.
Sure. I obviously focused a bit on casting. And so when I first am working with somebody, I make sure they're very familiar with the equipment, their grip on the fly rod, and managing the line. So line management, holding on to the fly rod in a way that is efficient for them. I'm not going to say the correct way, but an efficient way for them. And then I try to work on some casting techniques, but it really is line management is the first thing that people need when they get onto the water. So, of course, we need to be able to cast the line out there and get it to the fish, correct? But if they're not managing the line well, and it doesn't have to be super technical, it really is just keeping tension on the line, understanding the fly rod cast starts and ends with the rod tip pointed at the water, because that creates that tension at the end of the rod. You know, a few of those little things can go a long way with folks. I'm not so concerned about them having the most beautiful loop I've ever seen on the first day I take them out, but I want to make sure that they're successful and that line management skill is super important. I try to kind of assess with folks a little bit of their athletic ability and interest there. That I think that's important too. Sometimes if I can find an analogy that might relate to them with a sport or some other activity that they do, that can help a lot. And that's so a good point. Yeah. Sometimes a little bit of that question and answer with folks of finding out other things that they do, or with kids, a sport that they play, if I can, any analogy that I can try to find with that can help. And I even sometimes with adults, I use what might seem like kid-like analogies because they're out there to have fun. They're on vacation. Like try to keep it a little bit lighthearted. And then I would agree with you that less is more. Sometimes that silence and just kind of letting people do their thing after you've given them a little bit of framework is important. I don't want people to build bad habits. And so that's where I feel like my role changes a little bit to where it becomes more coaching. And I get called that every once in a while. I get called coach by some of my clients because I will maybe present the lesson, present the program, and then talk about kind of that evolution as we take it to the water and the different places we're fishing and what we're doing. And then I'm just little tips and tricks at a time. I was recently teaching a casting lesson at a fishing show, and the person had cast several times, and I really tried to keep it to like 3 points. Like I wanted her to walk away with 3 things for her to remember instead of being it too much. And I've had my own experiences where at the end I'm like, whoa, this is way too much for me to try to remember. I've got to break it down into 3 things that I remember from this clinic that I just took. What are the 3 things that really apply to me that I'm going to take home because I can't remember all the stuff?
I think that it's funny that you say that. I also have a rule of threes, 3 things in my, like 3 things I can remember if I'm going to give a talk or a presentation. Like I break things down into sections of 3 and I teach in sections of 3. And I was just reading something recently about this, like physiologically the brain has like, the reason why you have 7-digit phone numbers is because that's like 7 numbers is like kind of what you can remember. But if you're under any kind of duress or stress or anything, like that 7 goes down to 3. And so 3 is a very, I've heard that before and I've used that as well. I think that's a great technique. When did you get out to West Yellowstone? When did you say, yeah, this is forever because, or maybe not forever, but this is quasi-permanent at least because you're from Ohio and I know you've fished all over the world and done lots of different species, which is another theme on the show is being able to experience fly fishing, not just in Montana, but you have done that. And also you're kind of back at West Yellowstone. What is it about that fishery that makes it special for you? And when did you know that it was going to be the place?
I'm not sure I picked West Yellowstone specifically. That wasn't the ultimate destination necessarily. But what I love about West Yellowstone, and shh, don't tell anybody this, there's a lot of fishing around here. There is fishing in every direction outside of town. Yeah. Small streams, creeks, lakes, big rivers. I mean, every direction within a couple hours, you could be fishing to different types of water and even, you know, some different species that obviously all live in freshwater around here. But, my very first trip out west was, on a family trip when I was 12 years old, and we were down in Wyoming outside of the Tetons and in the Tetons, visited Yellowstone a little bit, but that was a year of a lot of forest fires. And so we actually didn't see Old Faithful and didn't spend a ton of time in the park, although I did fish the Yellowstone River on that trip.
I remember visiting the park and not seeing things because of fires when I was a kid too. Like I remember like driving around and smelling smoke and being like, my dad being like, we got to get out of here.
Yeah. It unfortunately it is part of living out west right now. Sure. And has been for years, and even last year on the East Coast experienced some smoke. But I visited at that point. We floated, we camped on the river, we fished, we horseback rode, we traveled around and toured, and I just remember thinking, I remember being in Jackson then and just thinking, wow, huge mountains, big rivers, wildlife, all these amazing things, and people who wanted to be out in the mountains doing all this fun stuff. This is where I want to be. And so initially I figured I'd end up in Wyoming, and just because I enjoyed the area. Reality set in that I was not going to live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And so I, close enough, I started in Island Park, Idaho, and worked down at Henry's Fork Anglers and Fly Shop. That was my first job out west after college.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yes, and fished the Henry's Fork the whole summer. I mean, I maybe fished another body of water. I may have fished five other bodies of water maybe that entire summer. I spent the whole summer fishing the Henry's Fork.
And how old were you?
I was 22.
Okay.
And I had other trips out west prior to that, from the first trip to moving out here. But and that included Wyoming and Colorado and Montana. So moved out west and worked in the fly shop, knew I was going to work in the ski industry that winter, and made that happen to be down in Idaho, Wyoming. So I've always been right on the border of Wyoming, but West Yellowstone worked because this is where I found my first full-time guide job in the area, which wasn't for a few years till after that. And I started working at the Firehole Ranch on Hebgen Lake. So that's how I ended up in West Yellowstone. And doing the 6 months living in a different place after that, because I would go down to Targhee in the winter and back to West Yellowstone in the summer, I decided I wanted to be in West Yellowstone full-time year-round.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then you've got the park there too, and that's pretty cool. I mean, that's a unique part of fishing, quote, fishing out west that is kind of very cool about that specific area. I mean, Yellowstone National Park is a treasure. It's beautiful. And it has kind of, like you said, there's lots of fishing in every direction. And I feel like Yellowstone Park itself is like that. Like if you just put yourself in the middle of Yellowstone Park, like there's all kinds, there's small creeks, there's big rivers, there's hiking and lakes and, you know, mountain creeks and all that just in the park. It's like a little microcosm of fishing out west in my brain. I don't know if that's what you think, but that's my perception. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good description. And, you know, ironically, I live in West Yellowstone, Montana, but I'm a mile and a half from the Wyoming border. And now I spend my winter job, I spend 3 months in Wyoming, and then the summer, I'm about half of my guide trips are in Yellowstone National Park. And I feel like it's true. It is a great kind of, I mean, it's hard to call 2.2 million acres a microcosm, but I guess compared to the other places, but
all the states, the western states, but that's true. It's not very micro. It's pretty big.
It is really big, but ironically, conveniently, all of the roads and trails have water near them, you know? Yeah. And because of just the way the road system was set up after the initial trails and access into Yellowstone, most of the roads have rivers or bodies of water near them, or they're going to one. And so there's a lot of accessible fishing in the park. And I certainly enjoy having it this close.
Do you remember when you were up there and you started fishing Yellowstone more often? And really bringing that into, like you said, you fish there or you guide there, half your guide trips are in the park. Do you remember, I know it's a ways back, but do you remember a trip or a day or something that stands out as like a light bulb moment for you where you really kind of progressed as an angler because of the park, or it taught you something where you're like, oh yeah, this is a little bit different, or I just noticed the park, you know, you have to kind of act a different way up here or something like that.
Well, I think some of the rivers out west that we fish are tailwaters. So we're fishing below a dam. And that is convenient that we can fish those many times of the season because you have a fairly regular temperature of water. It might be influenced by runoff, but that consistent temperature allows you to fish in the middle of the winter, the spring, the fall, and the summer. And I think the light bulb moment for me in the park was when I had first moved out west, I did not have a lot of experience fishing in the park, and I didn't understand the different water temperatures, and I didn't understand that certain places would fish better at certain times of the year. And so it really wasn't until I lived and guided here that I understood, and also some of it's just seasonal with when fish are spawning, like cutthroat spawn at the beginning of our summer. So some of those rivers are closed. That keeps you out of that. But as far as water temperature goes, I didn't realize that you couldn't fish certain rivers in the middle of the summer because they're too hot because of the influence from the thermal activity. So yeah. Yes, that was definitely a light bulb moment for me when I moved to the area. And it might seem obvious to some, but I don't think it's obvious to everyone because I still see people fishing the fire hole in the middle of July and August when that river is clearly 70 degrees. So yeah. It's not healthy for the fish to be hooking them in that temperature if you were to hook one and then put it back in that super warm water.
Right. And you said if you were to hook one. And I mean, that is definitely important for the, you know, the population of the fishery and such, but also to your point, it's not good fishing. Like it's not going to fish good if it's too warm. You know what I mean?
Correct. And there's some cold streams that flow into that warm water. There's lakes that they're connected to. Those fish move and get into colder water. So they're harder to catch and yeah. You're better off fishing elsewhere. And that is, you know, when you said kind of micro, a part of what Yellowstone National Park is versus it being larger, that is one of the beauties of their bodies of water in the park that are from 9,000 feet down. And so yeah. There is colder water in the middle of the summer. It takes getting creative and traveling around, but certain parts of the park fish better during our season. The whole park doesn't fish well during the entire fishing season. And okay. That's a good thing.
Oh, that's a great thing. Let's break it down. Let's talk about the seasons and what water, like what do you think seasonally about where you would go fishing? And let's take the type of fishing out of it for now, but let's just say the different seasons and we can bring it into the park and West Yellowstone. So you could throw the Madison in there, I guess, if you wanted, but like, what do you in that area, when you think seasonally, where are things going to fish better? You don't have to name rivers if you don't want, but just, sure. You know,
no, that's okay. Yellowstone National Park's fishing season opens on Memorial Day weekend. So the end of May. And that is kind of the beginning of runoff on the Madison outside of the park. But there's places on the Madison that could fish well. Every year it's different. Sometimes that weekend around here is 70 degrees, and sometimes that weekend there's 8 inches of snow on the ground, and it's right. Cold and wet. So it yeah. A lot of that fishing destination may be influenced by the weather at the time. But inside the park, when the season opens, we are fishing lower elevation streams. They're the first ones to have hopefully been through runoff. Snow's melted. There may be a little snow on the banks, but that cool water is balancing out with the warm water coming from the geyser basins.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the geysers. Like, I'm glad you brought that up. Does that really affect a lot of stuff? I mean, the geysers and the temperatures of the water?
Absolutely.
I thought that was going to be a dumb question, but then I heard you say it, so I've got to ask it.
It's not a dumb question at all. Midway yeah. Geyser Basin, which is well-known geyser basin, has 4,000 gallons a minute of hot water flowing into the fire hole.
Right.
Right out of a hot spring and a dormant geyser. So, yes, that temperature okay. is much warmer right there and below that geyser basin than it is in other spots.
But it's not just the fire hole. There's other places, too, that might be a factor.
Yes. There are 10,000 thermal features throughout Yellowstone National Park. They are not all in lower Midway and upper geyser basins on the Firehole River. They are all throughout the park. So there are influences. Sometimes it's to our advantage. When we have winter-like weather during the fishing season, then those are the places where you might see more bug activity on a cold, snowy day.
And that's fishing. A great example of the seasonality, like you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. The fishing, that might be where I want to go that day when it's snowing. That's not the day that I'm going to be at 8,000 feet trying to find fish that are willing to eat in cold water or muddy water. You know, some of those places get off color. So cloud cover, chillier weather can bring on the hatches. And if the water's a little bit warmer, then that temperature can be perfect for bug activity. So yeah, thermal activity can be good and then it can be bad. You know, the Firehole River gains all of its heat and most of its volume from those geyser basins. But other rivers have thermal influence also. Inside the park, a number of rivers have other geyser basins that are bringing in water, or they have a geyser area or just thermal features in the river or along the bank of the river. It may not even be an established geyser basin that helps keep those as destinations during certain times of the year where that water is warmed up and it's in great shape when the weather is cooler because of the thermal influence. As the summer progresses, we get a hotter temperatures, drier temperatures in the middle of our summer, then other bodies of water from higher elevation become a better destination than anything that's got a lot of thermal influence to it.
Okay. So May, sounds like you're saying that May is kind of the beginning of that runoff. And so the lower elevation streams are going to be where you kind of start. And then as you move, so that's spring maybe-ish, beginning of summer.
Yep.
And then summer now, are you having to hike up to more smaller streams, smaller waters? Can you still fish bigger bodies of water, or is it, does that drive like, okay, it's middle of summer and now I'm going to be more into the backpacking type fishing or more of an outing, or are there other places you can go to that are not quite like, I don't have to backpack up to a lake?
Yeah. July and August, it just depends on how warm it gets and how soon it gets warm for us. July and August, I'm leaving those lower elevation streams as much, maybe this western side of the park. That's where I'm moving up to the northern part of the park, the northeast corner, the eastern side of the park, the southern part of the park, anything that's coming from a higher elevation river or stream or lake, those bodies of water are going to fish better, because they have cold water. And, some of the cutthroat fisheries start to open in July because they are considered a late season spawner. So late spring is when cutthroats spawn. So fishing to them after the spawn is not only responsible, but that just timing wise works out well with water temperatures too. And then, yes, by the end of summer, I mean, it depends on our weather a little bit, but I'm certainly hiking into different spots in the backcountry, lakes, small streams, great destinations. That's when they fish the best. You know, the summer's getting a little shorter, but those warmer temperatures are when you want to be up in those bodies of water.
Okay. And then take me into fall and winter now. Then seasons are changing, starting to cool off a little bit. Maybe we've got some snow coming up in the mountains.
Yes, which for here, we could have a dusting of snow. I mean, similar to down in the Wasatch, you probably get a dusting of snow maybe some years by the third week of August.
It's not quite Bozeman down here. Like, I got friends up there that get like snow year round sometimes, but
yes. But by Labor Day, we've probably seen snow somewhere in the mountains, or we've had one 3-day period where it got below freezing at night and you're like, ooh, it's chilling off. We're getting some frost. So
it's exciting. Yeah.
It is. And as soon as that starts, then you start to see some of those low elevation streams fish again. And okay. It really depends on our weather pattern at that time of year. Are we going to have an Indian summer where we have a long drawn out, you know, beautiful sunny days in the 60s in the afternoon and it's bright and clear every night. And then it warms up in the afternoon. That's going to dictate fishing in different spots than if we're starting to see a pattern of, you know, every 5 days we've got 2 to 3 days of cloud cover and rain and some snow, then that's really, it's going to start to slow down the fishing at higher elevations and make the lower elevation areas fish better or have more success in some of the lower elevation streams. So it's almost like a bell curve. You know, you start out low elevation at the beginning of the summer, you move up to higher elevation in the middle of the summer, and then it drops back down to low elevation, kind of a little slower slope on that downward going into the fall. And then Yellowstone National Park's fishing season ends when the road closes, which is October 31st. So, yeah, our fall is really September and October, and the weather changes quite a bit in October. People are always surprised when they leave, even Bozeman. I have a number of clients from Bozeman that come down and they come down in the fall and they look around, they're like, it's winter here. And I'm like, ah, it's just the beginning of winter.
That's great. That was really helpful and really broke it down well. So appreciate that. When you say fish better, so let's assume where we are, where we need to be, where it's fishing good. Okay. How do you now approach that stream? And now I think I'd like to start getting more into the tactics of the sight fishing as well. But actually, let's just set sight fishing aside for a second. And let's say should be fishing good. How do you approach that stream as far as entomology, bug life, nymphing versus dry fly fishing? Is there patterns that you are familiar with that kind of play in, or do you're just aware of the hatches and looking for that type of thing, or where do the hatches come into those good fishing waters now?
Yeah, when I think of what's going to fish better, I'm looking at a water temperature that's ideal for a fish safely. So 52 to 65 degrees is kind of an ideal temperature for trout to be metabolizing. And when I think we're more likely to see bug activity, I mean, my preference is to be sight fishing or dry fly fishing if I have the opportunity. And I certainly nymph and throw streamers and swing soft tackles, which can be very effective. But summer fishing for me is the opportunity with some dry fly fishing. And so,
well, let's talk about that then. Let's stick with that. Let's talk about what you want to do and how do you approach it if that's what you're trying to do?
Sure. I try to have a general idea of what the hatches could be and what bug activity I anticipate seeing, right? So that's where I'm going to figure out where are we in that stage of the hatch. You know, certain bugs fish better at different times of the day. And obviously with different temperatures of the water, that could change too. Where I know that some bodies of water, the hatch activity might be better in the middle of the day when it's warmed up, especially early season. There's other rivers where we're more likely to see bug activity first thing in the morning or in the first half of the day before the sun gets high and the temperature gets really hot. So it's not that I have to know those temperatures, but maybe just knowing that bug activity at that time of day on that particular river is super handy. And I'm looking for insect activity. I'm looking for the bugs themselves on the bank of the river. I'm looking for them on my way to the river. I'm going to notice if I'm driving to a section of river and I'm getting a lot of bugs on the windshield before I ever get there. You know, are there caddis, just clouds and clouds of maiden swarms of caddis that I'm driving through on my way? That's a big clue of what I might be fishing with that day. And also just looking at the weather, because maybe some mayflies hatch better when it's sunny out and some mayflies hatch better when it's cloudy out. So, all those factors that I take into before I ever get to the water, when I finally do get to the the body of water, lake or river, I might see birds working. I might see swallows diving down on the water, catching bugs. I might see them, the birds flying around a bridge on my way there. So that gives me a clue that there's bugs and there's activity going on. Now I need to figure out where the fish are going to be so that I hopefully now know what bug to put on. So it's a lot of observation before I get there, before we actually get to the water. So I have an idea of what to rig up, how we're going to approach the water and what we're looking for.
So the observation piece makes a lot of sense, especially with figuring out the bug species, I guess, that you're going to put on. So you have an idea like, hey, it's caddis. It's probably going to be caddis. It's probably going to be this time of day-ish. A lot of that's coming from experience. But I mean, if you have a, I don't know what your opinions are on this, but I mean, if you have a hatch chart, you have a ballpark, right? You have, mm-hmm. Hey, this hatch is going to happen in these months. Now, I get it. It could be super early or late, depending on if it's an Indian summer, like you said, or something, or the temperatures might range in that area. It's not like 1 May till 30 June. This is when the hatch is. Mm-hmm. But that, I would say, I mean, for most people that don't have the plethora of experience that you have, or maybe a guide or even somebody that fishes that place year round, they could go to that and say, okay, this is the bug that should be hatching around this time of year. And then if they're observing that, that's like a backup, like, okay, yep, I'm seeing that. So now you kind of know what species. I'm curious how you, someone who's dry fly, wants to dry fly fish and wants to sight fish, are you targeting those specific windows of the day where that, you know, you kind of know that more of the fish will be eating on the surface and then just kind of laying off the rest of the day? Or because what happens a lot of times, you go to the river and you think you've got an idea and you see the bugs, but you don't see a lot of risers, you know, what sure. do you do? And are you now saying, okay, I'm going to fish nymphs or larvae or emergers, or, you know, are you just kind of muscle through that and we're going to put dries on and try and make it happen? And, or, you know what I mean?
Right. It depends a little bit on the body of water. If I'm fishing pocket water, if I'm fishing in riffles, or if I have really technical flat water that I'm okay. looking for. So we'll just stick with rivers for now. So if I go to a flat body of water and I'm not seeing any risers and I may or may not be seeing bugs, then I'm probably going to look for a specific fish. And then I'm going to figure out how to catch that fish. So if I find specific fish, whether I'm looking in the water or I see an occasional riser, then that might be a dry fly, that might be an emerger. It depends on what my observation might be on the bugs and the time of day that I'm there. You know, am I seeing bugs or are there all spinners on the water and we haven't seen a hatch? These are the mature adults that mayflies say that have already mated and now they are flat out on the water, dead mayflies. So that might change my approach to what I'm going to fish with at that moment. I'm not going to be anticipating seeing those bugs hatch again and maybe until later in the day from where I am right now. Now, if I get to a body of water and there's some bug activity, but I'm not seeing fish rise, but maybe it's a lot of pocket water. Maybe there's a lot of structure. There's a lot of elevation loss. There's a lot of rocks with slicks and seams and moving water where I know a fish should be living. That's when I'm going to probably start prospecting and trying some different dry flies that float on the water that may be similar to what I've seen or anticipate seeing. So let's say there should be caddis, or I saw a few caddis on my way to the river. I see no fish rising, but there's bugs, a few bugs. I might start with just a size 16 or a size 14 elk hair caddis, something that floats really well in water like that, something that I can see that looks yeah. super buggy. And I'm going to make sure I have good drag-free drifts. They're fairly short. And I'm going to prospect along the bank, under the grass, around the structure, then start working towards the middle of the river and fishing the slicks below the rocks and fishing some of those transition zones of the fast to the slow. I'm really paying attention to if I'm missing fish, if fish are coming up, or a fish coming up and refusing my fly. And then I'm going to start to change something. You know, I'm probably fishing that on 4X, that size fly. And so when I change the fly, am I changing it to a different color or a different size? And personally, I would pick size first over color. And then I would start to make adjustments, you know, maybe fish the same water over, maybe fish a new piece of water around there, and start to really pay attention to what the reaction is by the fish. If it's absolutely nothing, which happens all of us.
Certainly.
Yeah. Yeah, then I am probably going to change baby dry flies again. And if I'm looking at water that's deep enough in a few places that I know there's got to be fish there, putting a nymph dropper below that dry fly is always a possibility.
Okay. Two questions then. So yep. What is it about the water type that makes you more prone to prospect when the water is moving versus slow? I have an idea, but I want to know what your opinion is. And, you know, what puts you in that more of a prospecting kind of mindset, or maybe you're going to be looking for that type of water, if versus the flat water, if you're just in that situation. And then, the second thing is why in those types of waters, maybe it's the same question, different way, but why in those types of waters are you more likely to have luck?
In that super flat water, if I were just, this is a good question, because I feel like I could describe kind of different types of water here. In that really flat water that I consider to be more technical, presentation is key. So if we're hitting the water a lot with our cast, with the way that the line is landing, the fly, any fish that was maybe, I mean, possibly in a quarter of a mile where you're standing is probably going to be spooked, and they're not going to be interested in feeding. They're not going to be comfortable. They're going to be nervous. And so those fish are more likely to go deep or stop feeding, or they're just not relaxed and comfortable, which is what we want them to be so we can convince them to eat our fly. Okay. So
a quarter mile,
possibly there's, okay. I was thinking about some
like
larger,
I'm imagining a big quarter mile otter, please. Okay. I got you.
Yeah. I was just thinking about some rivers are, and this isn't just in Yellowstone National Park, but there are some rivers where you have really long runs, really long flat body pieces of water. And I was thinking about one that if I walked up to it and I started just blind casting to the far bank where I know there's usually fish, but there were no fish rising, and I start blind casting over there and I'm false cast, throw a fly in the water, nobody eats it, big long drift, and I pick the line up out of the water and cast it back over there again, there probably was a fish possibly standing in front of me in the middle of the river or on that far side. I just spooked it. It just ran upstream all the way through the run. Spooked every other fish up there. And I know some people are rolling their eyes thinking that's ridiculous.
I'm not rolling my eyes. That's a large piece of water. So
I know a quarter of a mile seems like a long way, but I just thought about, oh, how long is that run on that one particular spot? Maybe if I spooked that one fish, he just ran up through the run and everyone else just sounded the alarm and said, don't eat. There's bugs.
Could have just ruined, I mean, even if it wasn't a quarter mile, but let's say it is, you could have, how long does it take you to fish a quarter mile if you think you haven't spooked fish? You know, you might have just ruined an hour and a half, ruined in quotation marks. I mean, you're still out having a great time, hopefully, but you know, you might not be in good luck.
You've put the fish down.
Yeah,
right?
Another hour and a half or something. I mean, depends on how fast you fish a quarter mile, but all right. So that's a good point. Yeah. All right.
So the good thing is with some of those rivers that have long runs, they also have riffles. And so they're going to have some elevation drop somewhere or a point where the river narrows. Maybe there's rocks and some structure. So those are the areas where we might see more bug activity. That might be an area where I am more likely to prospect in that faster moving water instead of in the slow moving water. And if I'm not throwing a dry fly in there prospecting, I might be more willing to swing a soft tackle. You know, soft tackles very often imitate emergers. They imitate that bug coming up to the surface. And, you know, if we've come up to a body of water, not seen a lot of bug activity, maybe I swing soft tackles in the in the riffles and in the drop-offs, and I swing a soft tackle that I have confidence in, or I swing a soft tackle that I think is similar to the bugs that are on the water. A hare's ear is a great, partridge and hare's ear could be a great soft tackle. They could imitate caddis or a couple different mayfly patterns. That gets me another little clue. It gets me a little piece of information that I might need to apply to my next stage of fishing in that particular area that day of what dry fly I'm going to use or the size.
When you fish the soft tackle, are you targeting more bottom up? So you need to get that soft hackle down and it's the rising motion, or is it more lateral that you, or how do you decide on that kind of presentation?
Yeah. Most of my soft tackle fishing, I'm going to start near the top of the riffle and work my way downstream. And I'll start with a short line in close to me and then start to lengthen that line out. So I'm covering water going out towards the middle of the river. And because of the way, you know, I'm still going to have probably an 8 to 9 foot leader on there. And the soft tackles that I have are tied on a heavy wire hook. They have a little bit of wire on them. They're going to start to sink as soon as they start drifting downstream a bit. It's more swinging, but as they get down, when that line comes under tension, then they start to rise up back towards the surface. So I'm not trying to get them towards the bottom of the river. We're definitely looking, depends on the depth of the water that I'm fishing in. But most of the time I would say it's kind of more mid water column and then working up from there.
Yeah, that's a great point, because when in my brain, I think like emerging nymphs, you know, or coming up from, they start at the bottom, but you don't necessarily have to be on the bottom for it to come up. That's a really, really great point, because if you're nymphing, you know, more than likely a lot of times you're on the bottom or you're in that cushion of water along the bottom, you know.
Or you think you are. This is like a whole nother hour and a half podcast. You think you're on the bottom, or you're trying to be. You're doing all the things that get your fly down to the bottom because you think that's where you need to be.
You want to be there.
Right.
You might not actually need to be there, or you might not actually be there.
Correct.
If you need to be there, you might not be there. And if you are there, you might not actually want to be there.
Correct.
That's true. But okay, that's a great comment on the soft tackles. I think that's important, because there's a lot of times when I'm in that area where, you know, I don't really want to fish a dry dropper, you know, and I don't really want to be on the bottom. I know I kind of want to be in mid column, or maybe I've had luck in mid column with a dry dropper, and maybe a soft hackle would be a great option at that point, you know, like, cause that's kind of, they're not eating on the surface, and I'm always kind of, they're always taking them on a merger or a dropper, and maybe a soft hackle. Or sometimes I'll be nymphing where I'll have a fly on the bottom and I'll have a tag fly further up in mid water column. And again, I might be wasting some time there where mid column, it's another really great way to target mid column, I guess is what I'm saying, that I don't personally think of enough. And you just brought that to my attention. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. No, that's good. And I mean, there's a lot of dry flies out there that don't sit awesome on the surface, right? You know, they are not tied with a hackle or something that sits them up on the surface. And there's dry flies that have that nymph shuck, that Zeelon tail hanging off, where it looks like the cripple pattern, right? So there's the adult has emerged, but that nymphal shuck is stuck on the back. So there's a couple different patterns there that I may not really want to fish them as a perfect dry fly all the time. I'm not always putting a ton of gink on them and floating so that they sit up on the surface, right?
Yeah. And I was talking to somebody the other day and we were talking, I forget who was on the show, but we were talking about when we were kids and we weren't fly fishing when I was a kid, you know, and you would hook grasshoppers up, right? Mm-hmm. We drowned those grasshoppers. I mean, they were down in the water and holy smokes, we caught a lot of fish on grasshoppers when I was a kid. So, you know, I've never fly fished a grasshopper below the surface, but they eat them down there.
Sure. I mean, that's one of the things I probably really love, and this is not necessarily a segue, but watching fish eat.
That's okay. We don't need to segue. We're doing great.
But it's watching fine. Fish eat, and you can watch fish eat things, and you're like, what was that? You know, maybe it was a drowned beetle. Yeah. Maybe it was a part of an insect that was underwater, which is like, you know, a whole nother tangent of fly fishing. But I think if there's not fish rising and you can still see fish in some of those places, you can still fish to them. That might be sight fishing. It may not be. That prospecting, I'm not going to concentrate on just dry fly fishing in certain places, depending on the time of year and the bugs. My prospecting might be subsurface a little bit too.
Okay, that makes sense. And there was a third water type you brought up at the beginning that you would also maybe approach differently. If we get there, we're supposed to see bugs. We think it's this bug. There should be a hatch kind of, but maybe we're not seeing risers. And what was that?
I think I was talking about pocket water and just faster moving water, which would be maybe some like, you know, your image of a high mountain, small stream, plunge pools. Water pushes up against a cliff or around some trees, and then there's faster moving water, a lot of elevation drop. And that's where I might start out with a dry fly that I can see. That's an attractor pattern, something that's really buggy. It might share some qualities of the other bugs that are I expect to see that time of year. So, the stimulator patterns work great in different sizes and different colors. Stimmies can imitate caddis in different sizes. They could imitate stoneflies. They could imitate hoppers. They could imitate, you know, different terrestrial patterns. I think a high floating dry fly that's buggy that you can see can work really well in some of those spots, especially in the middle of the summer.
Right. And if you're in that kind of water, you're probably up higher in elevation where, you know, fish are a little bit more desperate or more likely to eat whatever they kind of see versus you're down below the dam or you're just even lower on a freestone where there's maybe less options. I don't know. I mean, that's the whole like mountain stream brook trout eating the giant Elkhart caddis kind of jumping out of the water fishing.
Sure. They have a short growing season, right?
Yeah.
I mean, their season, they got to make the most of summer. So
yeah.
I think that's definitely a good option. And then it may be that you get closer to the water and after you fish for a little bit, you find a spider web or you look on a rock and you see a couple bugs scurrying or dead in the area. And then that gives you another clue of another bug that you should be trying and a high floating dry fly that is going to stay on the surface in some of that water could be perfect. And maybe it's one of the more general types of dry flies, like a parachute atom, of a wolf style pattern. Any of those are going to float well, and you can adjust color and size if you need to when you get specific. If you're seeing fish.
You see that little white parachute, no problem. That's pretty good.
If you see fish refusing it, then you can make some adjustments, but sometimes those are a perfect pattern.
Yeah. Okay. One of the things that has helped my sight fishing game more than anything is understanding or at least acknowledging that I'm looking for or that I'm seeing feeding fish. Like, I don't know why that wasn't a big deal for me before. And I'm curious if it is a concern of yours or how much time do you spend thinking about that? Or like for me, at least on some of the waters that I've fished, when I started giving more attention to fish that I knew were feeding, then I was catching more fish. It kind of like, that fish looks really big, or I really want to catch that fish because he's in a tight spot or whatever. But when I started to identify the feeding fish, then my probabilities kind of increased. Is that something that concerns you, or how long will you watch to see if a fish is feeding, or how long will you watch or stick with a fish that isn't feeding, or how does that play into your calculus, I guess?
For my personal fishing, and I would say a good part of my guiding in the middle of the summer, that is a large portion of my time is spent with feeding fish, looking for feeding fish, or trying to catch a feeding fish. And it's funny too, that's one of the questions I've always wondered about, because I learned how to fly fish before I learned how to spin fish. And so it's one of those things that I always wondered with spin fishermen who are always fishing below the surface. Do you not care about the feeding fish that are on the surface that you can see?
That's a great point. Like, what is yeah. like, what was I doing when I was like a little kid? Like, and there's all the, because they were definitely rising on the Stillwater River and absorbing. I mean, they were definitely fish rising all the time and bugs everywhere. But I mean, what was I thinking? Like, I guess we'll just catch the fish that aren't eating up here.
Right. That's always been a funny one to me. I'm like, well, the fish are right there and they're eating.
That is a very funny
dry one. Technique yeah. that works for the ones that you can see eating. So, no, I definitely am looking for feeding fish, and I'm looking for fish that I can see moving. You know, there are fish that eat on a beat sometimes where they'll rise and then keep moving and swim around and come back instead of a fish always sitting in one place and just kind of eating on the conveyor belt, you know, that's coming by them. There's a little of both.
That makes sense. Yeah. And I was talking too about nymphing as well. You know, like when you're nymphing, if you're nymphing and sight fishing and nymphing, like you mm-hmm. see the fish and some aren't, you know, that specifically, but yeah, even with wet dry flies too.
Yeah. When I'm sight nymphing, I'm definitely spending a lot of time watching the fish before I make a cast. Because I've got to see where that fish is holding, if they're moving. And then I'm thinking about where my fly needs to be at that angle to get down to where the fish is. And when is it, you know, where does that fly need to drop at what time when the fish is moving towards it? It depends on the speed of the water, depends on which way the fish is feeding with the current. And sometimes it's, I'm watching a fish feed, and I'm like, I can probably just drop this fly and let it sit on the bottom until that brown trout swims by, give it a few ticks, and then he might come up and eat it. You know, and I say come up and eat it, he's not going to rise and eat it, but he's going to go down to eat it. But the fly, I'll be bumping it up off the bottom and he's more willing to eat it, versus other sight fishing situations where it is very technical on where that fly needs to land to get to where the fish is. So
let's talk about that, the technical part of it.
Yeah, I will spend a lot of time studying and watching a fish before we make a cast, for sure.
Define a lot of time.
There's probably been times where I may have watched a fish for 10, 15 plus minutes before we made a cast. It might be that it depends on how frequently the fish is eating, and it depends on what their pattern is, if they're moving or if they're sitting still, how many bugs are coming over them. Maybe it's less than 5 minutes. Maybe I see fish rising and I'm like, we're good. You know, there's three fish that have risen along the bank. Let's start at the lower one and work our way up. And they're eating every mayfly that comes over them. Every PMD is getting eaten. Every caddis is getting eaten. Okay. You know, make sure the line's good, the tippet's good, we have the right fly on. And I hopefully place the angler in the right spot. Try to make sure they're false casting in such a way as to not spook the fish, and then present the fly.
What else about the presentation? So you've got now a fish that's feeding. I think one of the things you brought up that I think is important, I wonder if you can expand on a little bit, is the timing of it. You know, the timing of that presentation. This is something that I have trouble with, or can be difficult for people to kind of bring into their cross check, is that the fish, you might have the perfect presentation for 3 seconds ago, but it's not going to work now. So it's not, you know, it's not going to convince this fish. What are some things that you think about when you're looking at that timing and casting and those types of things?
Well, trout typically need 6 or 8 inches in front of them to see and react to food. And so some of it is, where are you landing the fly in relation to the fish in their pattern, right? So it takes paying attention to how they're rising, and are you putting the fly in between the next two bugs, or, you know, dry fly fishing to trout, we're not trying to hit the fly, not trying to hit the fish on the head with the fly. It's not like fishing for permit or bonefish in a spot where you've got a heavy fly and it goes down and then the fish hopefully sees it as it's moving, because we're not moving the fly here. We're trying to get a dead drift. So anticipating, you know, how many flies that fish is eating in a row, of are they in the type of water you're in, So if there's globs of midges going around in a back eddy, that's a lot different than if you're fishing to a single fish that's eating dry fly or eating mayflies that are just coming down the bubble line to them.
Yeah.
And then how far the fish is willing to move out of their lane to eat something. You know, fishing golden stones in a big river, big, wide, deep river, a fish might be willing to move 2 feet out of its feeding lane to come and eat a giant stonefly. Then I don't have to be nearly as precise of where that fly is going to land. So sorry, that's a lot of opportunities there for a different answer. But I think you got to study that fish. And that's where I'm going to take one extra 30 seconds to study that fish and where that line is of where I want to land the fly before I make that cast.
It's kind of cool if you can embrace that kind of pacing of your day fishing, because, you know, I have people on the show and I ask folks, you know, what they could have done different as a beginner or what they would have told themselves if they could start over that would help them progress. And many, many times they say, slow down, right? And if you're sight fishing, I feel like if you're doing it right, or at least in a way that kind of we're describing, you have to slow down and observe some of these things if you're going to have success. And I think that's really cool, not just because you're going to catch fish, but also because it kind of unwinds your day, lets you chill out. It's a little more relaxing. You don't have to just like keep pounding the banks with streamers. You know, you don't have to just keep casting and mending and casting and mending. It can be a little more analytical. It can be a little bit more, not even like analytical is the right, but just it's a little more peaceful, I guess. It's a little more chill, I guess, you know, and I think that's a fun way to fish.
I agree. I think it is. And the time when you're holding on to your fly and you're waiting for that fish to like get comfortable again and eat for whatever reason, maybe an osprey flew over and a couple of the fish stopped eating for a minute and they all went down and then they all start rising again. The whole time you're sitting there with your fly in your hand and maybe you're doing something to dry it off and you're just chilling out for a few seconds, that's when you are going to look around and see birds. In our case, we're always looking around for wildlife in the park. So bears. I'm making sure there isn't,
bears, Alice, bears,
a bear walking down the bank, a whole herd of bison that's on the move. Like there's a lot to be observed, but I do think that's an enjoyable way to fish. And I do like that pace and I like it better than, yes, I move from run to run and work upstream, and sometimes I skip a run and all the rest of that, but it doesn't have that kind of aggro feel that I see some anglers where they literally run to the river and they are maybe throwing streamers, maybe they are throwing a dry fly, and they are just trying to cover the miles as fast as possible and cover all the water and run. Yeah. And I'm sure they, you know, a few might be listening to this podcast and saying, she didn't know what she's talking about. You got to cover the water as fast as possible. And that's how you catch them. Okay. That's your style. And I hope you have a great day and enjoy it. But I like that slower pace, watch the fish, watch the bugs, and make a game plan before I make that cast.
Do you think that it is useful or helpful to go into your day of fishing and decide like, I'm going to sight fish today, and so I'm going to approach the river differently than, say, somebody who is just fishing and also sight fishing at the same time because they see a fish, you know? I mean, do you think that you are more deliberate in that way, or does it happen kind of in congruence with just the way that you fish? Like, I might go fishing and I might sight fish to several fish that day, but it wasn't like my goal starting out. It wasn't like the way that I wanted to fish. Do you think that people would be well served to just kind of take an afternoon, maybe half the day, and say, we're slowing everything down, I'm going to sight fish? Assuming there's sight fishable water, you know, it's some rivers are easier sight fish than others.
Yeah, for sure. I think it would definitely serve an angler well, and they would try out some different skills and learn some things by doing that, whether it was a half a day, a whole day, or doing something different. I think that it's a skill that anglers should have, especially if they're somebody who likes to travel and fish and do different things, because I know I should use examples of Yellowstone, but I went
you
can to Argentina.
Do. No, you don't have to. Yeah.
I went to Argentina for the first time. Can't believe it was finally in 2023 because I've been wanting to go to Argentina for almost 25 years. But we did a variety of different types of fishing, and there were certain rivers that the goal was, you know, water we could see into, we could see fish. They were sometimes rising, sometimes weren't. There was slow water where the fish tended to sit and eat. Those fish, you could have fished to them a variety of ways, but sight fishing was the most rewarding and most fun way to fish to them. And I could have rigged up nymphs probably and caught a different fish in that pool, but I could also fish a big dry fly and have a fish, beautiful brown trout, come up and eat it. So I think if you're going to fish the same water for your entire life and it doesn't involve sight fishing, great. But if you're going to travel and fish different trout fisheries, I think you need to know how to sight fish a little bit, because you could find yourself fishing with friends who maybe want to go fish a hatch. You could fish on certain types of slow water that maybe are super weedy and they have a tremendous bug life on them, and you can see fish and you can see fish rising. You should have an idea of how to approach that river and where to stand and what kind of steps you need to go through to try to catch one of those fish, because not all techniques work on all types of water. And that's not a place where you could do a few other things that if you're going to fish there, you probably need to be studying your target and figuring out a game plan to catch that fish. So something that should be practiced and thought about and have a game plan. And definitely go try it out in different places and maybe approach your home water for a certain day of the year or a certain time of the day and say, the only way I'm going to fish today is with a single dry fly, and I'm going to try to have a game plan before I put that fly in the water, whether it's to a rising fish or prospecting into water where a fish should be.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about approaching and standing. So, I mean, you don't want to spook fish, so you want to go slow and you want to kind of avoid false casting where you're spooking fish or shadows where you're spooking fish as some examples, I guess. But besides moving slow, how else do you approach? First, how are you, do you have any tips or like kind of things that people don't think about when you're trying to see the fish in the water? Assume they're not rising or not very right, you know, when you're trying to find fish, whether they're rising or not, I guess. And then how do you, now that you have a target, how do you approach it?
I always have polarized sunglasses on, and I always have a hat on. And most of the time it's a hat with a brim. Even if it's cold out, I'm going to try to figure out how to have a hat with a brim. It just reduces the glare and I think makes things easier to see. Yeah. So polarized sunglasses and a hat right out of the gate. And then I think after that, I'm always looking at how am I going to approach the fish so I'm not spooking the fish with my presence or my false cast, but also how close can I get to that fish where I can make a cast and the fish will see the fly first and quickly. And so that approach means that I am not going to always be downstream of the target. Sometimes I am perpendicular to the target. Occasionally, the target is downstream of me. And so I want to make sure that I know how to mend and reach cast. Reach cast is super helpful there, especially I'm thinking in slower water where I land the line and the fly on the water. I don't want to then use the mend to lift the line out of the water, which could disturb the fly or disturb the line and then potentially spook the fish. So that positioning of myself, I'm going to kind of think through all those next steps of what's the next cast, what's the next line management that I'm going to do. And I hate to take this back to skiing, but
it's great. That's why I brought it up at the beginning. I think it's awesome.
I watch World Cup alpine skiing, which is the season just ended. And I watch World Cup cross country skiing too. But alpine skiing, you can see like Michaela and a lot of the other skiers, when they're not in the gate ready to go, when they're waiting, if the camera goes to them, they know every turn that they're about to make, and they are visualizing like which angle, which side of their ski they're going to be on when they're about to enter the gate for that race. They know every turn, they've practiced, and I'm sure there's a whole other part of this that I have no idea about because I've never been a ski racer, but you can see them making a plan. You can see them physically working through it while they're waiting of where they're going to make that turn. And I think in some scenarios for fishing, we have to go through that same process. Like we're seeing a fish rise. We're going to stand on the bank and figure out, okay, he's upstream of that rock. I can't be directly downstream of the rock because I won't get a decent cast to them. But now I need to be to the side of the rock. And then thinking through, where's my false cast going to be? Where's that reach cast going to be? And so once I have figured out that plan a little bit on that approach and where those casts are going to be and what my line management skills are going to be used, I can make little tweaks if it doesn't work. So if I make that cast, the fish doesn't eat it, I get my line out of there without spooking them, then I know I need to move myself two steps upstream and let out a little bit of slack line in that drift when I mend so that the fly drifts down a little farther and gets to that fish. It's easier to make those little tweaks after you've kind of got a little bit of that plan than it is to be constantly just reshaping the whole thing.
What have we not? I mean, there's a lot to it, but
I know.
What have we not covered before we move on in sight fishing that we have to cover? You're like, well, we can't stop talking about sight fishing if we don't cover this, Jason.
I would say the only other thing that I didn't mention in that kind of approach piece is, as much as you don't want to false cast over the fish because you don't want to spook them, you should be paying attention to where your false cast is unfurling. So where is that fly come, like on your forward cast and the tippet's kind of straightening out in front of you? That false cast you could do as a practice cast away from where the fish are just for a minute, just to kind of practice it.
Oh, I do that. Yeah. I'm glad you said that. I'll do that, especially if I'm doing it to like the bank and I'm not sure I can make that exact distance without getting on the bank or whatever. I'll be like, it's about that far. Let me cast over here. It's going to feel like that. Oh, you got too much line out. Okay. I feel good over here. But I haven't really tried it that way with what you're talking about. So that's a great technique.
Yeah. And your goal is obviously not to tick the water. It's not to land anything on the water. False cast that a few times. Look and see how it's straightening out. Look and see what the fly is doing at the end. Is it your casting technique or do you need to lengthen out your tippet? Do you need to change the leader? You know, there's other things there that you could change in addition to your casting. So I think that practice piece could be important too.
Yeah, that's great. Or just working on your casting and stuff like you were saying earlier.
Yes. A very important skill.
Okay, good. That's great. I have a couple more questions about Yellowstone that I wanted to ask. If you could only fish the park 2 days of the year, which 2 days of the year would you fish it and how would you fish it?
Oh, wow.
You don't want to say where. You don't have to tell me where you're going, but just like, you know, when would you fish? How would you fish?
That is so hard.
Only two. You only get two.
I know. I appreciate you giving me two. Yeah. I feel like I get asked, if you only had one, it's like, oh, that's not fair. Okay. 2 days of the year that I would fish. I would say probably early to mid-July. Because you have quite a few mayflies coming off. And I think finding rising fish, especially eating some of the bigger mayflies, would be the best. And then I'm going to pick terrestrial fishing sometime in August. And I know you want a specific date.
No, it doesn't have to be. You could say August. It's there's no rules on the Wait Out There podcast. Whatever you want to do, fine.
It's your podcast. You made the rules. Yeah. I would say the second or third week of August because I could have some good mayfly fishing, and then terrestrial fishing, and like again maybe the second week of August, just because ants, beetles, hoppers, so good.
Yeah, that's great. And it's really great if you have some of the knowledge that you dropped earlier about thinking about the part of the park that you're going to based on the temperatures of the water and things like that. That's super helpful. Because I think a lot of people, just the park is so big, like you said, like, oh, I'm just going to pick this one because I don't know, it looks pretty, or it looks like it'd be good fishing, or I saw somebody or heard somebody that caught a bunch of fish there. But you don't know like what the water was like, what the temperatures were like, what the cloud cover was like, what the sun angle was like. You know, you don't know any of those things. But if you have a season to go off of, like you presented, that's super helpful.
Well, I think a lot of anglers, Yellowstone is not somewhere they come frequently. And so right. For a lot of anglers, they travel, go to different places. They come to Yellowstone. They've always wanted to fish the Firehole River. They've always wanted to fish the Lamar River. And yes. Their trip coincides with when the family could get out. The kids are out of school. The campground right. was open. All these other things that are out of their control. And then they say, well, I really want to go fish it. And it's like, well, this is not the right time of year. It's either too warm or right. it's muddy and high and during runoff. And so sometimes you can make it work. But you know, if you're
that's a great point.
Limited yeah. time and limited money, you want to use that time wisely and be in the right zone.
And there's the right such time. A delta between when you schedule that trip and when you get there as far as the conditions. I mean, there's yes. no way of knowing. And unless, which is the advantage of having home waters, is you get to know those waters and you know. I mean, one of the advantages, you know, like, yeah, I mean, normally this is when it fishes good, but it's not fishing good. So I'm going to go to this other place or something. But if you're planning trip, like it's hard to do that because you're not there, you know?
Yes.
So being flexible, like you said, is a good way to handle that. And, yeah. Okay. I'm a slightly below average fly tire. If I was going to come out and fish in Yellowstone with you, Alice, what would be a couple of simple flies, not too many materials, that are kind of, I don't know, confidence flies for you, or flies that are general good flies to have in your fly box that we might be able to fish?
Well, similar to what I had talked about earlier, just kind of knowing the hatches of the time of year when you're planning on being there could be yeah. an important part of that. I think tying some dry flies that float well that you can see. So if it's a Parachute Adams, I don't always think of a Parachute Adams as being a really awesome, easy fly for
it's super easy to
below tie average fly tire. But I would say
I can manage it. I can do it. It takes a little longer. Yeah.
Yes. And even if it were another Adams style pattern, right? It doesn't have to be a Parachute Adams, but yeah. I think an Adams style, something that's imitating a mayfly that you could tie in different sizes and colors, depending on the time of year that you're there. You know, you're not going to fish PMDs at certain yeah. times of the year. You're going to fish betas, but
it's harder question to answer with dry flies because yeah. it's very hatch specific. But right. we can pick a couple hatches, and like, what would be a fly that you would tie for two different hatches that would be somewhat easy to tie?
And I was going to say with dry flies is, if I were going to pick two dry flies, I would pick something that imitates a mayfly in a small okay. that you could use. Change color, change size, different times of the year. And then I might fish the other dry fly that I might include would be a beetle. Only because I felt like it had a little more flexibility than an ant. A hopper would be the other choice, but I think of hoppers as being a more complicated fly to tie, and that you could find some fairly basic beetle patterns out there that involve four materials. You
right.
know, foam,
yeah.
body material, legs. You could tie some beetles that I think you'd be surprised that you could get fish to still eat them even early in the season. You know, it's not just a late summer deal. So, and then if I were looking at flies that I would fish under the surface, soft tackles are not that hard to tie. You know, body material, wire, and then the partridge feather, getting it to behave and do what it needs to be doing, or grouse
feathers. Once you get that technique, they're not that hard to tie. Yeah.
Right. If you can deal with that hackle, then you're probably going to be okay. Subsurface flies, I would also, you know, a hare's ear nymph or a pheasant tail would be good patterns that, similar to that Adams or Parachute Adams, you know, changing the size might be all you need to do to be successful with that nymph. That's something you could fish different seasons of the year in Yellowstone. We didn't even talk about this really, other than I was talking about not doing it, but you know, a woolly bugger is usually the first fly that most people learn how to tie. And that can be a great prospecting fly in water that you see no bugs and no fish rising. And a woolly bugger can be stripped like a streamer, but then it can also be swung through a run and given some action or not. And that can be super effective.
If you could only pass along two techniques to someone going into the park, two besides casting, besides be a good caster, like two techniques that you think would help them put fish in the net on a day out in the park fishing, what would those techniques be?
So when you said I couldn't include casting, does that mean I can't include like line management skills either?
Oh, that's fine.
Cause I feel like people miss fish a lot because they have too much slack in the line, whether it's at their hands or it's at the rod tip. And so keeping that line under the trigger finger, rod tip down, I think that's huge for people setting the hook.
That's totally valid. All I'm saying is like to tell them just cast better. Of course, yes, I should cast better. But is there anything else that I could do? Managing my line, that's very important. Yeah, and I think that's a great one.
I think line management, and then I think I would go back to that observation piece.
Yeah.
And because I have watched anglers park in a parking spot, they are already weighted up because they've been moving around, and they jump out of the rig, they grab the rod that's already rigged up, and they run right down to the water and then just start putting it in the water. And I'm like, did they not see what was going on? And they didn't adjust anything. And it's a totally different body of water than the last river they just fished, which was 15 minutes away. I get it. Right. But there's an enormous variety of the water that's around. And so I'm not saying that they have to walk painfully slow to the river, but at least look and see what's going on around you. And maybe you were kicking up hoppers the whole way over there. And you just busted through the sagebrush and kicked up a bunch of bugs. And then the first thing you threw out there was a woolly bugger or a nymph rig that you were fishing in a canyon stretch 20 minutes away, which maybe that was super effective over there, but it's not the type of water that you're in now.
Yeah. Especially in the park where there's so much variety, like you said.
Yes.
And like you also said, the road system and kind of you're traveling and you're probably going to see different parts of the park and see, you know, like, so that's really good advice. Alice.
Yes, Jason.
Before I ask you my last question, how can people find out more about you? How can they, you know, schedule a guided trip with you perhaps, or if there's anything that you want to share that you're excited about that you want people to find out about, where can we find those things?
My website is riversideanglers.com, and that Riverside Anglers is also my handle on Instagram. And I have a fairly full season coming up. I've got maybe a few openings towards the end of the season. My women's fishing class, women's fishing school that I do at the beginning of June has a few openings in it still. I have a few hosted trips during my off season to some saltwater destinations, and then I am going back to Argentina in April of 2025, so I'm excited about that.
Awesome.
My show season is over for now. I have a few Zoom presentations to a few clubs, but I'll be attending some fishing shows next year.
Cool.
And yeah, my website's probably the best way to get in touch with me. Just leave a message there and I'll get that in my email and then respond back and we can make a plan.
Okay. We will link to that in the show notes, and they can either find information about like the fishing class and the saltwater stuff on the website, or they can contact you through the website if they're interested. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Last question. You ready?
I'm ready. Your lead up is making me very nervous.
I'm not supposed to make my guests nervous. So
I know.
That's not good. That's not good. Okay. If you could go back to when you first started fly fishing and give yourself two pieces of advice, one more of a tactical piece, one more of a philosophical piece, what would you tell yourself to help you progress as a fly fisher?
Ooh, interesting. From a philosophical standpoint, just kind of like we talked about in the beginning about me being a yes ski instructor, where I said yes to helping teach a snowboard lesson, even though I hadn't snowboarded much, and yes to doing other things. It was a group lesson. I was just helping, but I wasn't going to say no. I would say that, and I think some of this is an evolution of the sport of fly fishing a little bit too, but you know, I have lived in and been in places where I was seeking out the type of fly fishing that I really enjoyed and wanted to do, which made me a better angler. But what would have also made me a better angler was probably going and doing some things that felt at the time out of the box. You know, I snubbed my nose at chasing certain species of fish when I was younger, because I was like, no, you don't fly fish for that. I'm not going to even try. It's like, well, what? Maybe a sink tip line or a sinking or an intermediate line and a bigger fly, and my 6-weight would have been fine for catching smallmouth bass. Like, that was absurd for me to have said that I only fish for trout in freshwater.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. And now I'm right there with you. I'm guilty as charged. Yes.
Yeah.
It's so good to hear you say that. And because it's one thing for me to say it, or like for me to write a blog post about it, but for you to like say that is so, and for a lot of the people that listen to this show, you know, like military members or people that travel, like there is great fishing. And fly fishing is so much more than catching trout. So, and for someone who's doing it all the time, you know, to say that is really, I think, instructive and useful and helpful for people, that it can really reconnect them to the sport, you know, where they can really enjoy fly fishing, even though they live in Georgia, you know, which was my case.
Right. Well, I'm not sure how much military application there is for this, but I caught a muskie on a fly this past year. I've caught several pike on a fly. Never would have thought that back then would be possible. Yeah. And I will say, from a military aspect, I do help with Warriors in Quiet Waters trips, and guide with those in the beginning of our summer. And then I have several other current military and former military clients. And I was so excited. I talked to one this past summer who I guided for the first time, and he's been deployed in places all over the world and has taken a fly rod with him every time and has caught some of the craziest species of fish that other people, it's like a bucket list trip for them to fly to that ocean and catch a fish there. He takes his fly tying stuff, and when he has a chance to get out and try something new, he's like, oh, yeah, I've caught one of those. Oh, yeah, I caught one of those. Oh, yeah, we just went out on the beach and started casting. And so
I feel like you're talking about the same guy that I talked to. He was a JTAC, so a guy that I used to work with, like a ground guy, and I was in the airplane, and he was in Africa. And I mean, he took his fly rod to Africa and caught fish in the ocean. Like, and he was in a not nice part of that continent as well. So that's cool. It's cool to hear you say.
Yeah. So, yeah. Think outside of the box, and on the species. And then I think that qualifies for philosophical, right?
I'll say that's philosophical as well. Yeah. I agree with you.
And then from a technique standpoint, I would say that most every technique that we want to try and learn how to fish, and this kind of, it goes a little bit in the philosophical, but it just takes understanding the gear and maybe getting some knowledge from somebody and then practice. So it may feel like it's hard and out of reach, because there are types of fishing that are hard and it takes practice and gaining knowledge to get there. And I think about when I was younger, I may have been super intimidated about fishing a particular hatch on a piece of water that was, you know, famous for this hatch, and it's so hard. It's like, nope, you just got to go do it. And it took asking some questions and somebody saying, all right, I'll go out with you tonight for a couple hours and I'll show you. Showed me how to reach cast. That was the biggest takeaway from the whole night, is I didn't know how to reach cast. So I learned how to reach cast from, I was working in the shop and it was from a fishing guide, but just being willing to learn and learn some of those techniques. And aside from that, I was fishing with my dad in Pennsylvania when I was in college, and we were fishing in the spring, looking for bug hatches, looking for fish rising in small creeks. We were just driving around different parts of PA looking for fishing. one day. And you can see where I obviously inherited some of this, but my dad comes up to me and I'm landing a fish, and we'd been fishing two different pools for a while, and I'm landing a fish, and he comes up and he's like, "What did you just catch that on?" And I had a streamer in my box, a little one, single hook, black and blue something that somebody had given me, kind of a more traditional streamer size pattern. And he's like, "Oh, you're a meat fisherman because you're fishing with a streamer." Obviously, I inherited this from him, but I was like, I didn't feel ashamed about it at all because I wanted to catch a fish that day on that particular river, and there was nothing going on. There was no bugs. There was no hatch. There was nothing going on. So I still wanted to fish. I just needed to try a different technique. And I'm not bothered at all by streamer fishing now. The technique that I try to focus on for myself is dry fly fishing, but I certainly throw streamers out of the boat, wade fishing in a bunch of different places. So I think back to that technique part is you need to learn some of those different things. It might be hard and you have to get some knowledge on that information. And there's places to do that now that's easier than it used to be.
Practice. I like it.
Yes.
That's very tactical and very good.
Span the horizons.
Yeah, I love it. Alice, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Great words of advice today. Great tactics and techniques. I love talking about this type of stuff, and I know I learned a ton. I think it's cool too that you're still learning, and that's important to you, that you're still getting coaching and practice and learning the techniques of instruction that we talked about in the beginning. That's pretty cool, and it shows that you really care about what you do and what you're doing on the river and instructing as well. So thank you for that, and thanks for being on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jason. I've really enjoyed chatting with you today. And I appreciate you having me on the Wade Out There podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing podcast. You can learn more about some of the topics we discussed in today's episode show notes. For more fly fishing ideas, stories, and artwork, check out my blog and online gallery at wadeoutthere.com. If you want to make Wade Out There a part of your own fly fishing journey, please subscribe and share. Until next time, wade out there.